Again, I want to thank you for coming out today. It's kind of been hot and muggy, hasn't it? It's kind of all saps your strength, but we're here today, and the Lord is going to strengthen us by His Spirit. And I suspect in a group this size, there are some golfers in the crowd, or at least maybe I should say some former golfers in the crowd. I've enjoyed playing a few rounds of golf myself over the years. Believe it or not, I even had the status of being a member of a golf course. It was a public golf course way back when. I was single at that time. I was fresh out of college and employed at my first job. And I thought, wow, I'm going to be a member of a golf club. And I was. Back then, I worked the second shift at Kraft Cheese Company way back in Illinois. And on several occasions, I would get up in the morning and head out to the course and at least get 9 holes of golf in before I had to punch in for my second hour shift. Again, it was a fun time of my life. I was footloose and fancy free, and that was nearly 40 years ago. So it was a long time ago. If you've never played golf, you're probably familiar with the term mulligan. Anybody hear the word mulligan? I mean, if you're a golfer out there. In a casual round of golf, a mulligan means you get a do-over. You get a second chance, especially when you have committed a grievous error on the golf course and you struck the ball so poorly that the ball lands maybe in the pond or the woods, or in my case, it would land in the neighboring farmer's cornfield. And it wasn't really good to go climb the fence and get those balls. But here's the thing. You get a do-over in a mulligan, and you're not penalized. Isn't that great? You're not penalized. It's kind of like a gentleman's kind of thing. It's like, hey, you know, I'll give you another shot. Mulligans are great. They're also completely taboo and totally illegal in competitive play. If you're out there on the golf course and you're actually in a league or competition, you cannot have a mulligan. I remember one story of one golfer. He told me about his infamous mulligan. As he tells it, he was golfing alone that day, and after hitting a terrible shot, he decided that he was going to drop a ball and take his mulligan. As it turned out, on his do-over tee shot, the shot went straight into the hole. He had a hole-in-one, just like that. And somebody witnessed this shot. And all of a sudden, he became the golf course celebrity for the day. He got his name in the newspaper and a photo of him. But what he didn't tell them was that it was his mulligan shot. Today, he even confesses that he feels quite sheepish about all the attention he received, since the hole-in-one he made was actually his mulligan. Anybody hit a hole-in-one here before? I've never done that. Well, this morning I'm preaching out of the book of Deuteronomy. And maybe I'll preach from Deuteronomy again if a mulligan is granted to me, or if the Lord leads. But for now, I want you to know that the title of Deuteronomy, the book, this is one of the books of the Pentateuch, besides being a word that doesn't easily roll off one's lips, it means repetition of the law. This title actually comes from the mistranslation of a Hebrew phrase, which means copy of this law. In the Hebrew language, this Old Testament book is referred to as Ella Hadabarim. How about that for a word? Which means these are the words, or Deborim, which means the words. That would be the title. That's another title for the book of Deuteronomy. This makes sense since the opening sentences of the book begins with the words, these are the words of Moses that he spoke to all of Israel in the desert east of the Jordan. That's how the book of Deuteronomy begins. Now, it's extremely important for us to understand this, to understand the background of what's going on here, not only because not because of the first few chapters of Deuteronomy, but through the entire book. And this is why I opened my message with the story of my friend's mulligan. Because in a sense, we are witnessing God here offering a mulligan to the Israelites. They went up to the tee box and they struck, and the ball went crazy somewhere into the farmer's cornfield. And they need a do-over, don't they? You see, Moses is standing before a new generation of Israelites, and he's going to tell the story of the preceding generation from 40 years earlier, and the preceding 40 years, which began with some miraculous and historic events. namely the 10 plagues of Egypt, the pillars of cloud and the fire that God was in and brought the Israelites out of Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea. But here's the thing, even though that story began well, it ends up resulting in some serious negative stuff, punishment and death because of a generation who did not believe in God. The 40 years prior to Moses standing before the Israelites, as he's doing at the beginning of Deuteronomy, those 40 years saw Moses lead God's people out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, their destination, a parcel of land that offers freedom and protection and abundance beyond belief. That was the promised land that God promised to give his chosen people. And that began centuries earlier with Abram. The promise he gave to Abraham. We go back into the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 12, beginning in the verse 4, it says, "So Abraham left, as the Lord told him, and Lot went with him, and he was 75 years old, and he set out from Haran. And he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all their possessions, and they had accumulated all the people they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan, which is the promised land. And they arrived there," the Bible says. "And the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, 'To your offspring I will give you this land. I give you this land.'" So as God, as he always does, he's making good on his earlier promise. And he's speaking through Moses to the people of Israel. And making that promise, God did some amazing things. First, he heard the Israelites cry for help when they were in slavery. He raised up a man named Moses, who by God's mighty and outstretched arm led the mass of humanity out of Egypt toward freedom. But this is when the trouble begins. And I don't mean to insult your intelligence. I'm sure you're well aware of what happened next. Instead of taking a relatively short journey to the promised land, according to Deuteronomy 1, verse 2, it should have taken 11 days for the Israelites to get to the promised land. It took them 4 decades. This is the setting in which we find Moses at the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy, 40 years later, once again, standing on the doorstep of the promised land, exhorting God's people to go in and possess a land that God had promised to give him. In a sense, God is giving the Israelites a do-over. True, maybe not to the earlier generation that perished in the desert because of the rebellion and lack of belief, but to this generation who also experienced the harshness of the desert. You know, it's interesting to think, to take a moment and think about those who are now standing on the brink of the promised land. As far as their age goes, there probably wouldn't be many people over the age, say, 50 or 60, would there? All the rest would be younger if they were born during the Exodus. Because it was 40 years in the desert, right? A lot of things happened in the desert, including new babies and children growing up. And maybe the young people there who were in their late teens, early 20s, they saw a lot of what was going on in the desert, including the grumbling and the complaining and the unbelief. And they could have inherited that, possibly. So for the majority of the new generation of Israelites, standing there once again on the brink of going into the promised land, they never would have experienced the taskmaster's whip and brutal tactics. They never experienced that. Most of them had never laid eyes upon the city and the pyramids that their parents were forced to build with the bricks that Pharaoh forced them to do them. And their stomachs would have not known anything but quail and manna. Can you imagine that? Being in the desert and having only to eat those two items? Boy, I bet they were itching to get into the promised land. So their life experience would have been quite unique indeed, because they were both exposed to the harshness of the environment, because it says the vast and terrible desert, wilderness. They were exposed to that. And they also had to witness God's righteous judgment on an unbelieving generation. That must have been difficult for them. But at the same time, they also experienced God's faithful provision for 40 years because they never went without. God always provided what they needed. Maybe not always what they wanted, but what they needed to survive. Now here's where I need to take a little detour in my sermon, which seems appropriate since we're talking about the world's most famous detour of the Hebrews. And I want to ask you this question. What are we to make of God's seemingly drastic and over-the-top punishment of the Israelites, namely their 40-year banishment in the desert? Because God says right there, they're going into the desert, and you're going to die in the desert because you did not believe. You're an unbelieving generation. Many might say and have said that this punishment does not seem to fit the crime. Like, this doesn't fit the crime. I mean, okay, yes, they didn't believe, but is that worth a 40-year sentence in the desert? It's okay for you to think this. I probably held this view for many years, especially when I first read it as a new Christian and not having given it much thought and was uncertain what to make of it. But I pose this one question to you this morning. Did God send the Israelites into the desert wilderness to merely punish the Israelites for their rebellion and unbelief? Or did he have another higher goal in mind beside that? I think that's a fair and honest question to ask. And I like to think he did. What I'm saying is that many may view the Israelites' punishment as terminal. In other words, complete and final and without any hope of forgiveness. But I don't necessarily see it this way. I mean, think of it this way. The greatest leader that the Hebrews ever had, Moses, he too was banned from the Promised Land. Moses even begged God to let him enter. See Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 23 and 26. But he was not allowed to. But he was allowed to go up to the mountaintop and look in to the Promised Land to see what the future held for those who he was leading. Well, this is different, you protest. Moses still had faith. He wasn't like the others who rebelled and had no faith. But this is exactly my point. What if God, because of his wisdom and his mercy and his compassion, decided that it is better for the faithless Israelites to wander the desert for 40 years in hopes that they would come to their senses and find their faith? It would be better that than to let them into the Promised Land without faith. And perhaps this is what God was doing. If it takes 40 years to find your faith, so be it. It's better to come to faith late than never at all. And I believe that when I finally get to heaven, I'm going to meet a lot of Israelites who never made it into the earthly Promised Land, but made it into the heavenly one because they had to go through the desert. They finally repented and found their faith somewhere in the desert. And every one of them is going to say virtually the same thing when I see them in heaven. They're going to say that their 40-year detour was ultimately worth it because although they missed the earthly blessing, they did not miss out on the heavenly one. If they had had a do-over, would they have entered the Promised Land by faith? I believe they would have. Of course they would. Hindsight is 20/20. But see, the Israelites that were banished to the desert, they couldn't change their past. All they could do was live with the consequences of their sin and move on. Confess their sin and trust in God, of the God of love, who reminds us every day that this life is not all there is to living. We live in this world in which we live and we have our being. It's not the end all or be all of our existence. We are simply passing through this world. And if we have faith in a loving and forgiving God and His Son Jesus, then missing out on certain earthly experiences doesn't mean that we have a terminal or fatal condition. Because God has something so much more magnificent and great for us on the other side of this life. This is exactly the theme of Hebrews chapter 11, isn't it? Abel, tragically killed by his brother Cain, at a young age. We don't really say how old he was, But he failed to experience much of what life had to offer him. But do you think Abel is sad and regretting his life right now? Not in the least. He is with God in heaven with so much more experiences, better experiences, than anything he had ever experienced on earth. And what about Noah? Does he not experience God's love and protection and forgiveness? Of course he did. And he needed God's forgiveness even after he had built that monstrosity of an ark. He still needed God's love and forgiveness. And Abraham, the author of Hebrews, the author of Hebrews tells us that he was a stranger in a land that God had given him. That surely couldn't have been a piece of cake to do that. How would we handle ourselves if we were treated as foreigners in our own country? Here we are, one day after America's 250th birthday. We celebrate our country's founding and the freedoms and the rights we cherish. But what if one day all these privileges and comforts and rights were taken away from us? How would we respond? What if all of a sudden we had to enter 40 years into the desert? And what if, when that happened, would we finally come to faith in God? Could we ever say it was worth it? Or would we just bemoan the fact that we just have lost all our earthly and worldly freedoms? It's like we'd have to weigh it on a scale. Do we want the earthly pleasures, or do we want God's blessing in eternity? If we have to go through severe trial and tribulation, could we ever say that it was worth it? That in giving it all up, we found our way back to God? And I'm not condoning the Israelites' unbelief or the rebelliousness. I'm not talking about the rebelliousness. That is a sin. But God is a God of mulligans. If you've watched the news lately, you probably have heard the latest theme in public sentiment. According to certain polls, a good percentage of Americans are seemingly not proud of being American, like 50% or over 50%. And I know this makes many of us who are patriotic, it makes us angry and disgusted, especially those who have fought and given their lives or their sacrifice, put their life on the line. I consider myself patriotic, and I am repulsed by those who would say terrible untruths about our country. And at the same time, I sort of understand where they're coming from. Why is it that so many do have negative feelings about the United States? And I think the root of their feelings may come down to the frustration that they do not see the country living up to the ideals and the standards and the goals that America was set out, had set out those ideals. But I think the critics have made one major fatal flaw, one major error, one major mistake. They have misplaced their blame. In my opinion, it's not the country's fault or the idea of independence or democracy or capitalism. They always like to point the finger at some of those things. Whatever. I think the blame falls squarely on every one of us who believes in the false notion that when things get difficult in our lives, or challenging, or nearly impossible, that somehow we think to ourselves, God hates us. And is somehow out to hurt and to harm us. And to punish us. And this is the exact twisted and erroneous belief that caused God to send that generation of Israelites into the desert. He said, and I read this from Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 27. You grumbled in your tents and said, and this is after the Exodus, after the spies went in to see the promised land and they came back, and out of the 12, two of them, they all had good reports of it. But 10 of them said, we cannot do that. There are giants there. There are fortified cities. There are great walls. We cannot, and there's so many people. You grumbled in your tents and said, the Lord hates us. He brought us out of Egypt, they say, to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us. Could you think of anything more further from the truth? That was that earlier generation. And that's where they were. emotionally and intellectually and spiritually. I want you to take a moment to assess the last 40 years of your life. Now, for some of you, that's going to be difficult. For a 12-year-old, oh, I see, 40 years, gee. Okay, think about your last 12 years of your life. And some of you are 80. You might have a hard time remembering the last 40 years of your life. But I want you to think about that and ask yourself, can you honestly say about God, is He a God that is out to get you and punish you and make your life intolerable? Is that how you see God? Or is, when you think back on your 40 years, that He has preserved and protected and cherished your life, giving you blessings too numerous to even count? Whichever way you may happen to feel or think about that question this morning, remember this: God allows for do-overs. God allows for the mulligans. And as long as you have breath in your lungs, God is ready to restore your faith and give you all the privileges of being a child of God this morning. That 40 years, you look back on it, some wonderful things I'm sure happened. Some tragedies probably happened, but it's water under the bridge now. And we take away from that, and we ask the question, was God faithful or was God unfaithful to me? This earth and the world and all its joys and trials is only the beginning of what God has for those who love Him. Like the new generation of Israelites standing at the doorstep, ready to go in to the promised land, a new adventure awaits. But it must begin with faith. Not just any faith, but in the faith in a loving, forgiving God and His Son Jesus.